Authorities at Colorado State University say they want to keep concealed handguns off campus. That's the goal of a policy they approved. And now they face the complexities of doing that in a state where concealed weapons are allowed. Here's Grace Hood of member station KUNC.
Last December, Colorado State University's Board of Governors voted to ban concealed carry weapons on campus. At the time, the Associated Students of CSU were the lone voice of dissent. But recently, that opposition has gotten louder. At a press conference on the Fort Collins campus earlier this month, Terry Ryan of the advocacy group Rocky Mountain Gun Owners says the university policy would violate Colorado's concealed carry law.
If CSU persists in trying to ban firearms on this campus, a lawsuit will be filed.
Standing aside Ryan is the region's county sheriff, Jim Alderton. He says if the CSU policy is put into place, he will not jail anyone found guilty of violating it.
How does that work legally? I mean, aren't you required to enforce the law? Or?
What CSU is trying to pass is a policy, and their position is that the university policy trumps state law and the U.S. Constitution.
And you're saying?
Absolutely not.
Under Colorado law, campuses do have the authority to implement weapons control policies.
Brad Bolander is spokesman for Colorado State University.
That's been demonstrated previously by just about every other campus in the state.
Bolander says the ban won't go into place until a specific university policy is approved. So far, CSU officials have been poring through public comment on a draft of the plan. Right now, Colorado statute does not specifically address handguns on college campuses, and that's created some of the confusion in the CSU debate. Since the 2007 Virginia Tech shootings, vague legal language has been a source of debate in other states, too. Legislators have introduced 56 bills in the last 3 years aimed at specifically addressing concealed carry laws on college campuses, either to allow or restrict carry. That's according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Vincent Bottolato is a policy analyst for the organization.
While there's a lot of talk about it, it doesn't seem that legislators are really willing to move these bills along very far.
In recent years, only one state has passed a law addressing the issue. In 2004, Utah began allowing faculty and students to carry concealed weapons on all of its college campuses. But the national debate continues. Both sides point to research they say illustrates that their policy would create a safer campus environment. Inside the bustling student center at Colorado State University, the majority of students seem to agree with junior William Campbell.
Personally, I think that no public institution has a right to infringe upon our rights, which allows us to carry these guns.
This is a viewpoint that students feel isn't being entirely heard by university leadership. Kirsten Silvera is a senior reporter with the school's newspaper, the Rocky Mountain Collegian.
And I think that is something that I've heard throughout my reporting.
The university's Board of Governors will meet later this month to review language on its concealed carry ban. At that meeting, they could finalize the process or decide to spend more time drafting the policy. For NPR News, I'm Grace Hood.
When he was a kid in the early 1970s, British writer Philip Hoare went to see Ramu the whale perform at the Windsor Safari Park, just outside London. Ramu was an orca captured a few years earlier and by then trained to entertain.
The whale went through his routine, responding to his trainer's demands like a lapdog, when he leapt in the air and landed with a splash, soaking the thrilled ringside audience at this orca circus. It was as if he'd been beaten back by his captivity, even as his proud dorsal fin flopped impotently over his back.
Though captive whales would later disturb Philip Hoare, that first encounter sparked a lifelong obsession with these mammals and with the book Moby Dick. And for 5 years, Hoare traveled from New Bedford in Massachusetts to Nantucket onto Liverpool and beyond to trace the path taken by that book's narrator, Ishmael. The result is The Whale. It's a book that's part travelogue, part literary critique, and part meditation on these extraordinary and once exploited creatures.
When I was a boy, I ate whale oil margarine. My mother wore makeup made with whale oil. You know, people played tennis with rackets strung with whale guts, you know, wore shoes tanned with whale oil as well. So up until the 60s, certainly in Britain, whales were used as a resource.
How did you decide to use the story of Moby Dick as a kind of a device to tell the story of whales?
Well, like many people, I tried to read Moby Dick and didn't get very far. I had to take two or three runs at it before I actually got through it. And really, I suppose, like Melville, I felt you know, I just became so obsessed with the notion of the whale and it's the fact that it represents this huge paradox. It's the world's greatest animal, the hugest animal, and yet we hardly ever see it. And when we do, we just see this kind of jigsaw component, a fluke or a dorsal fin or a pectoral fin. We can never put this jigsaw puzzle together, and that's what I was trying to do.
Philip Hoare, you start the narrative in this book in New Bedford, Massachusetts, which at one time was the center or a center of global whaling.
Well, I mean, New Bedford, I think, is an amazing place. I mean, it was the richest city in America during the height of the whaling boom. You must remember that before the invention, or rather the discovery of petroleum in Pennsylvania in 1859, the Industrial Revolution was lit and lubricated by the oil of whales. Mm. So, you know, that's where street lighting came from. That's where candles, you know, came from. That's where, you know, machines were lubricated from. So it had a tremendous importance in the early industrial world. And that's why also whaling became important for America, because it was the first sort of global economic reach of the new republic.
I was struck by some of the facts in the book, that the heart of a blue whale is the size of a car, for example, that the humpback whale follows the longest, the longest annual migration of any mammal. And yet you write that we actually don't know a whole lot about whales.
Oh, you know, I mean, if you were to measure whale science on a scale of 1 to 10, we're at 0.11%, you know. We're just in our infancy of our understanding of these creatures, partly because up until very recently, you know, our relationship with them was entirely as a resource. They were an industry. They fed and oiled our world. So, you know, the notion of, you know, seeing them as a natural wonder is a very recent thing in a way. I mean, it's really started in the 1960s, the whole sort of humpback song, which was recorded by Roger Payne, the song of the humpback whale, which sort of made the album charts. And so, you know, we've moved very quickly in that way.
Man walked on the moon before we actually photographed whales living underwater.
Well, certainly sperm whales. No one had filmed a sperm whale underwater at all until long after we'd landed on the moon. You know, we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about the bottom of the sea. It's so impossible to actually study a whale like the sperm whale, which is the deepest diving whale. It dives for a mile. It can stay down for 2 hours. We don't even know how it feeds. You know, but sperm whales have huge teeth, canine, 42 canine in its lower jaw, but the females don't have those teeth, so those teeth aren't used for feeding. So even something as simple as how a sperm whale feeds, we don't know the answer.
How much do you think the way we think about, particularly about sperm whales today, comes from Melville's book?
We're kind of haunted by Moby Dick, and it's odd because one of the themes of Melville's book is that Ahab is a demented man because he's impugning evil to an animal, which cannot possibly think in those terms. And yet, you know, we live with this notion, you know, still of the whale as being a ferocious creature, of a sperm whale being a ferocious creature. I've been in the water with sperm whales. They are the most timid animals. They are freaked out by a dolphin. They are not these leviathans of yore. They are an eternal paradox. And that's why for artists, for writers, scientists, everyone, they just represent this extraordinary enigma.
As you say, you actually swam with sperm whales in the Azores. And, of course, this is the mythical whale described by Melville. What was it like to actually be in the water with these enormous mammals?
It's the single most extraordinary moment of my life. I must have hastened to add I was licensed by the Azorean government to do this. It's not something I would recommend. But I got in the water. I was snorkeling towards this pod of 12, mostly female sperm whales. I mean, these are big creatures, get up to 50 foot long. And as I swam to them, one of them detached from the pod and came swimming towards me, at which point I lost control of my bodily functions.
Mm. I mean, you were terrified.
I was utterly terrified, utterly terrified. It was like having a granite cliff swimming towards you. And I thought that the whale was just going to either swallow me or swim into me, because a sperm whale's vision is very limited. At that moment, I felt its echolocation moving through my skeleton, through my sternum, through my skull, creating a three-dimensional sound picture of me in its head. I physically felt that. It was the most incredible feeling. And then at the last moment, as it came as close to me as, you know, this microphone is, it turned and looked at me directly in the eye. And then it dove from this blue into the black below. I mean, the waters there are 3 miles deep, and just vanished.
It's an amazing culmination of a story that begins when you actually learn how to swim as an adult to this moment where you are in the water with these creatures.
Well, from my deep childhood fear of water, I mean, I as you say, I didn't learn to swim until I was 25. And, you know, I had recurring nightmares about sea monsters and whales and things. And so the writing of the book was a kind of confrontation of my own fears in a way and of the general fears and apprehensions and anxieties we have about the water and about what it contains.
Over the sort of the course of researching this book, the 5 years that you spent sort of following in the footsteps of Ishmael and learning about whales, did it sort of change some of your assumptions about both about the book and about the animal you were studying?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think I started out with quite an objective viewpoint. In fact, one of the things I wanted to do is portray exactly why sort of young men went on these extraordinary 5-long-year voyages off to sort of hunt these whales and try and explain something from the human side point of view. But the more I was confronted with the physical reality of these creatures, the more I felt, you know, it's like that moment when I got on the water with the sperm whale, I actually felt I wanted to apologize to it, which is not to come over all sort of new agey and whatever, but it's, you know, you just realize what these creatures have suffered at the hands of man, that they have always been the losers, you know, and, you know, whatever the political or, you know, economic circumstances, it's the whale that always loses out. And, you know, and they are an ecological barometer. And I think we ignore their fate at our peril.
That's Philip Hoare. His new book is called The Whale, In Search of the Giants of the Deep. Philip Hoare, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, Professor George Lakoff is a cognitive linguist at UC Berkeley. He's not a climate scientist, but he's written widely about the problem, as he sees it, in the way the whole climate issue is framed. And it starts, he says, with the term global warming.
I think it has been very problematic. Global warming applies to climate, not weather. And most people don't think of the difference. And so you shouldn't be talking just about global warming. You should be talking about the climate crisis. That, I think, is very important. And to then you explain what a crisis is. But the people who are in the environmental movement are very bad at communication, and they haven't done that.
But, I mean, it seems as if those facts are available. They're out there. They're being discussed all over the place. The facts are clear. Most scientists do not see what they do as a political calling, but a form of research that's rooted in facts. Yet polls show, George Lakoff, that about 57% of the American public believes that global warming is taking place now. That is down 14 points from October of 2008.
There are two reasons for this, the cognitive problems and then the communications problems. The cognitive problems with snow are these. People have, on the whole, a false folk theory about how snow works. They assume that if since snow is cold, it can't come from anything warm. But that's scientifically false, and they haven't heard that over and over and over. So they still believe snow can't come from anything warm. The second thing they believe when they hear global warming is that it applies to every place uniformly on the Earth. That is false, too. They're thinking about weather, not about climate.
Surely some of the problem lies with the scientists themselves. I mean, we heard last year about some climate scientists who were trying to muzzle dissent. I mean, that certainly fueled suspicion that climate change or global warming is a hoax.
Look, that was at a minor place, and you get some people who make mistakes.
No, I mean, we interviewed one of the scientists. I understand that. But the message behind that had an enormous impact.
That's right. And the reason that's right. And it's very important for the scientists to know that they don't know anything about communication. They're very bad at it. See, the scientists who study weather don't study cognition. They're not cognitive scientists. They're climate scientists. That's understandable. But they don't know that they can't communicate. And they don't know they need to get some people who know something about it.
In a strange way, George Lakoff, we are actually framing the debate because we're talking about climate change. We're not talking about global warming, right? I mean, could we be accused of doing this?
Accused is interesting. The idea of climate change actually was introduced by conservatives, by Frank Luntz, in the 2004 campaign. He found that global warming alarmed people. whereas climate change sounded fine. It was just change, as if it just happened and people weren't responsible. Hmm. And climate is a nice word. It sort of gives an image of palm trees and nice climate as opposed to hurricanes and, you know, and huge snowstorms and floods.
So climate change, in your view, as somebody who I have to presume does not agree with Frank Luntz, is not the best way to talk about this.
Yeah, I think the climate crisis is a much better way to talk about it. You want to say this is a crisis. This is a crisis for civilization. It's a crisis for life on Earth.
That's George Lakoff. He's a cognitive linguist and professor of linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. George Lakoff, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
The town of Prospect Harbor, Maine, sits across the water from Acadia National Park. It's a small downeast fishing village known in the region for its sardine cannery, Stinson Seafood. It's the last sardine cannery operating in the United States. It's been around for more than a century. And if you drive down the main street in Prospect Harbor, you're likely to see a large sign in the shape of a fisherman holding a can of Stinson's signature product, Beechcliff Sardines. This week, Stinson's parent company, Bumblebee Food, said that because of federal limits on herring catches, the plant was no longer economically viable. They plan to close the cannery on April 18th. The plant's 128 employees will lose their jobs. One of those is plant manager Peter Colson. He's been with Stinson for 39 years.
That's on the payroll. I started before I was old enough to be on the payroll, working in the plant. I would do other odd jobs, just try to make some extra money by selling dents, which is a dented product that can't be sold on the market, which I would buy for 8 cents a can and sell them for 10 cents a can and make 2 cents.
And how did you even get into the business in the first place?
Well, my father was vice president of operations. At that time, he was plant manager of the facility. We kind of grew up in the business. I'd watch what he was doing and just was interested in how the people got along so well together and worked together as an industry.
Now, you've been there 39 years. What did you think? How did you react when you heard that the plant was shutting down?
Well, the first thing I thought of was the people that I've worked with for so many years. We have one lady here that's worked here for 54 years. I've also held parties for two ladies that worked here for 60 years. There's a lot of camaraderie around here that people don't want to leave once they get here.
Is Stinson the biggest company in town?
Yes, it is.
The cannery has been in operation for at least 100 years, right?
No, that's correct.
What is the building like?
Well, we've done a lot of renovation. In 1968, the plant burnt down. And within a year, the Stinson family had put together a more modern facility using concrete and steel. And they've made this into a very nice-looking operation. They modernized the equipment. Back years ago, when I first started, you'd need 100 packers to cut the heads and the tails off with scissors. Now we have automated machines that will cut the fish. What we used to use 100 packers for, we do with 20 packers, and they lay the fish in the can, already pre-cut.
I understand this is the last sardine cannery in the United States.
That's correct.
In the country.
Yes.
Where have they gone? I mean, who's canning sardines?
New Brunswick, Canada will produce the remaining amount of sardines that are produced in North America. They're also produced in Europe and South America as well.
Peter Colson, what are your plans? I mean, after the plant closes on the 18th of April, what will you do?
Well, I have to facilitate the closing of the facility and make sure that we can, relocate the people is my biggest concern. And then I don't know from there. I would like to maintain my lifestyle in the town of Prospect Harbor, but we'll have to wait and see.
That's Peter Colson. He's the plant manager of Stinson Seafood Company. It's the last standing sardine cannery in America. It's set to close in mid-April. Peter Colson, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Patty Neiman. As we age, our appetites may not change, but that can mean weight gain. Just ask Shirley. We can't use her last name because of privacy issues at UCLA, where she's taking part in a study, but Shirley has something to say that might sound familiar.
Weight is a very hard thing to lose. It's easier to gain it than it is to lose it, and I probably have never been as heavy as I am now.
At 73 years old, Shirley says she is overweight, which is why when her doctor suggested she take part in a yoga study for seniors, she happily agreed. A few months later, she says, she saw big changes.
I had more endurance. I felt invigorated. When I left that class and I walked to my car, it was like the sun was shining and everything was terrific. So it made me feel very good.
And she lost weight. You've heard it all before. Exercise is even more important as we age because of the biological changes that happen to all of us. Dr. Cheryl Phillips is president of the American Geriatric Society.
Muscle mass, the amount of muscle we have in our body, decreases with age. So if you look at a woman who is 70 years old and compare her to what her body was like at 25 years of age, even though the weight may be exactly the same, she had more percentage of muscle in her body when she was 25 than she does when she's 70.
When younger muscle cells get damaged, they're quickly repaired. That's not the case with older muscles, according to UCLA geriatrician Dr. Jonathan Wanagot.
We don't know why muscles become smaller and weaker as we get older. There's a lot of different theories that have looked at this. I think one of the ones that's become increasingly interesting and popular is the idea that the stem cells within the muscle are not able to respond to damage or to aging the way that they did when we were younger.
And if damaged muscle cells aren't repaired, they sort of whittle away and die, says Wanagot. So not only do we lose muscle cells as we age, the cells we're left with are sort of worn out. Cheryl Phillips.
And if you think of muscles as being the energy powerhouse of our body, that's where most of the calories are burned. That's also when we talk about metabolism. What we're really talking about is how efficiently those powerhouse cells, the muscle cells of our body, burn the energy we bring in, and we know that energy as calories.
And if you keep your caloric intake exactly the same, says Phillips, those unburned calories end up as fat. And that's where exercise comes in. UCLA's Wanagot says countless studies have shown exercise, even among individuals in their 80s, works.
We know that exercise actually helps the muscle cells become bigger. And so there is an increase in the size of the muscles that happens with exercise, even in older individuals. But we also know that it makes the muscles stronger sort of separately from that increase in size.
At UCLA, geriatrician Dr. Gail Greendale has just started another yoga study with seniors to try to figure out what yoga poses work best for the older body.
What are the muscle and joint forces generated by each yoga pose? And will these muscle and joint forces be strong enough to be a training stimulus, that is to say, make people stronger?
Without injury, which is especially important due to another phenomenon of aging. Greendale says the immune system can get out of whack, turning on an inflammatory response when there's no bacteria or virus to kill, or keeping it on long after the body's invaders have left.
An inflammatory cell is there to destroy another cell. So if it's on and there's no invader to destroy, it will damage your own cells. Wherever the inflammation is going on, it can actually damage the cells of that part of the body,
causing more problems to aging joints. Greendale's yoga study is getting underway now. Patty Namond, NPR News.
New credit card rules go into effect this week, rules that will change the way credit card companies do business with you. The changes are part of the Credit Card Act of 2009, also known as the Credit Card Bill of Rights. The new regulations ban banks from things like suddenly shifting the due date for payments or imposing surprise interest rate hikes. NPR's Audie Cornish has more on the new rules and how they could affect you.
The new law requires credit card companies to do a better job explaining when payments are due and what the penalties will be if you only pay the minimum balance. Introductory rates have to last at least 6 months, and card issuers can't raise an interest rate in the first year after an account is opened. But that doesn't do a lot of good for Karen Finn of Silver Spring, Maryland, who has had to put away the plastic after her interest rate spiked.
I would say the reason I made sure I paid off my balance and don't use them anymore is because they increased the interest rates so, like, incredibly high. At one point, I think my one credit card was 29% interest. Yeah. And I was like, that's just too much. So now I just pay what I can afford.
But you haven't got rid of your credit card?
No.
Now, what's behind that?
I guess there's still some fear with the economy that I might need that credit to get me through a couple months of downtime from work.
Even at 29%?
Well, hopefully not. Hopefully not.
More changes, good and bad, are on the way. According to the American Bankers Association, some issuers are trying to offer cards with simpler terms or reward good behavior with rebates. But consumers can also expect more cards with annual fees or penalties for inactivity. Nessa Fettis is the senior federal counsel for the group.
We're in a period of transition where there's going to be experimentation and innovation. Banks will see how consumers respond. At the end of the day, consumers are going to drive the credit card product.
Georgetown University law professor Adam Levitin says just because there's a new law, that doesn't mean people shouldn't be scrutinizing their credit contracts.
The regulation said you can't do A, B, and C. Well, that leaves the door open for doing X, Y, and Z. So there's no question that every major card issuer has a team of lawyers and economists and psychologists who are working on this, trying to figure out where the sweet spots for how they can shape their card pricing so that they're the most profitable.
Because while the law provides more transparency, it doesn't stop banks from adding new fees and it doesn't cap interest rates. Nick Bork of the Pew Charitable Trust's Safe Credit Card Project says the new law will save consumers more than $10 billion a year. But it's not a silver bullet if you carry a monthly balance.
If you're one of those people, you need to realize that one of the things that the law does is it requires issuers to apply your payments in a way that's more beneficial to you. But if you're somebody who's only making the minimum payment due, the law won't help you. You have to pay more than the minimum payment due in order to get the benefits that the law provides.
Bork says consumer groups will get another shot at making the law stronger. This summer, the Federal Reserve is supposed to issue new rules limiting credit card penalty fees to, quote, reasonable and proportional amounts. Those terms are still undefined, but the central bank is still taking public comments. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capital.